Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Introducing WonderSuite from Bluehost.com, the tool that makes WordPress wonderful for everyone. Website creation is hard, but now with Bluehost, you can answer a few simple questions about your business and goals, and the WonderSuite tools will automatically lay out your WordPress website or store in minutes. Seriously. From there, you can customize your design, pick your brand colors, and add blocks. No custom theme or coding required. You'll get content suggestions that you can keep or revise, and with Yoast SEO built in, we automatically help you get found in search engines. From step-by-step guidance to suggested plugins to an AI-powered help bot, our built-in tools make WordPress wonderful for everyone. Whether you're a beginner or a pro, you can join over 2 million Bluehost users. Go to bluehost.com/wondersuite. That's bluehost.com/wondersuite.
I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the gram, stunt me, you're destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam, put some respect on my name. Sick like a bang, click and I bang.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. On today's episode, we have got on Nick Buckley, who is actually running for mayor of Greater Manchester. He is also the founder of an award-winning charity, and he's got a very interesting story. So welcome to the show, Nick. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you much for having me. I've been looking forward to coming on.
Awesome, man. Great to have you here. So I've done a brief intro there, but tell the people who you are and what you're about.
So, as you said, my name's Nick Buckley. I'm from Manchester, born on a notorious council estate, had a normal childhood. Well, it was normal to me at the time. Had no father, lived in poverty. But again, at the time, it's just life. You don't realise that. I then wasted my teens and my 20s thinking I was going to be a millionaire by one deal. Then in my 30s, I started working for a living. And I ended up working for Manchester Council, working with young people, trying to stop them getting involved in crime and antisocial behaviour. And then from that, I was made redundant. And I used that redundancy money 10 years ago to set a charity up to carry on that work, working on the streets, supporting kids to make positive choices. And that charity has been going for a decade. We've won a handful of awards. And then a couple of years ago, I was awarded an MBE off the Queen of England for that charity work.
Congratulations, man. That's an MBE is a big award. So congratulations for that. So I'd like to learn a little bit about people's past so I can understand where they are now. So what was it like growing up on, you said, a notorious council estate? What was that like back in that time? I mean, this is going back decades ago in Manchester. What was it like at that time?
So we're talking about the 70s. It was, for me, it was normal. It's only with hindsight you look back and you see the mistakes of where you lived and the mistakes you've made, the mistakes of your parents, possibly. I had a nice childhood. I had a loving family. I had no father. I have no memory of my father at all. My mum and dad split up when I was 2, never saw him again. He died when I was 7, a car accident. He went through the windscreen. I went to a poor school. It was a failing school. They closed it down the year after I left. It was that challenging that one of the teachers got stabbed 42 times in the chest.
Whoa.
Another teacher got sexually abused by a gang of lads in the stairwell. And I could walk from my English lesson to my geography lesson through a hole in the wall where the kids had kicked the breeze blocks out the wall to make a doorway. Yikes. That was the sort of school I went to.
Wow. Okay. Wow. Okay. That's heavy. And I mean, moving into the work that you did, Tell us more about that work. So you obviously came out of that community and you wanted to, I presume, give back and help to make things better. So can you talk us through that journey?
Yes. I didn't want to give back. I didn't want to make my community better. Okay. Now, that's just what happened along the way. Okay. So I don't want to take credit where no credit's due at all.
Oh, fair enough.
So for my teens and 20s, I was a taker. Okay. I took out the system. I took anything I could get my hands on. Legally, I wasn't, you know, I wasn't a criminal. I would claim benefits. Sometimes I wasn't entitled to the benefits, but I'd claim them anyway. And I just looked after myself. I was a selfish person, and I looked after myself, just like the vast majority of people in the country are. Mm. It was only when I got a job at Manchester Council, and I only took that job because at that point I was unemployed and needed a job. So I took the job again for me, not for anything else. And it was while working in that job that I started working with people whose job it was to make other people's lives better. Mm. And that was the first time I'd ever come across people like that. And they were being paid for it. It was a job. But it made me look at society and look at community differently. And then I got some other jobs within the council. And that was when I landed a job working with young people. And again, I only took that because the money was good. Mm. Again, looking after myself. And it was that job that really changed me, because I realized almost immediately I was good at this. Mm. This was something where I felt that I had not only a passion, but a skill. And that skill was, I came from the same streets as those young people. And I knew when they were pulling the wool over my eyes. I knew when they were lying. I knew when they were playing the victim card, saying, oh, I live in the deprived area. I've not got a father. My mum's like, oh, don't give me that, son. I've heard all this before. Mm. It's personal responsibility. You're the one who threw that stone that hit the bus. Don't tell me society made you do that. Take some responsibility. Mm. And I called it tough love. And there was love in that, because I wanted the best for these young people, and I wanted the best for their parents. And I could offer their parents help and support, because every parent I ever worked with wanted their child to do better and wanted their child to have a good life and do better than they did in life. And that's innate in all parents. And I wanted to tap into that so me and the parents could get that child back on the straight and narrow. And this was early intervention. This was before these young people were causing serious problems or were being arrested. It was about stopping it before they got that far.
I got you. And where do you think that you yourself got that sort of mindset of personal responsibility for? Because it sounds like when you're describing perhaps your late teens and your early 20s, it sounds like you yourself describe yourself as a taker. And so I assume you didn't really have that necessarily instilled in you. So where do you think that mentality came from?
Good question. I've just finished, a couple of months ago, I finished writing a book. Part of it is about me, part of it is my journey, and I'm linking it all the time to personal responsibility. Mm. So I've given this a lot of thought, and it comes from several things. It comes from, as a child, I lived with my granddad. We shared a bedroom. He was the only male role model in my life for the first 10 years until he died. And he'd tell me stories about the Second World War, because he was in the Navy, being sunk by torpedoes, shark-infested waters, in China, eating snakes. And these were the stories he would tell me at night in bed that would make me want to travel, that made me want to do something. So he instilled this sense of adventure into me. Mm-hmm. And then when I went traveling, I realized for the first time how lucky I was, that it didn't matter that I grew up in poverty on a council estate in South Manchester, because I was still in the top 1% of lucky people in the world. And that makes you reevaluate your life and how you look at things when you realize I'm poor, but yeah, I'm still in the top 1% of the world. And I've never experienced hunger, and I've never experienced abject poverty. So what have I got to complain about? Yeah. And I remember talking to a family living on the streets in India, and they'd had a good day. And a good day to them meant the father had collected enough food for a family meal that day. And that's humbling. And they were happier than most people I knew back home. And they were living on the street corner in this wooden makeshift box. And that makes you really understand poverty and how to be grateful and appreciate what you have.
100%.
And then, again, with the personal responsibility, I've run my own business in my 20s. That instills personal responsibility, because if you don't do it, it doesn't get done. Mm-hmm. And just like you now, you run your own business. You don't work 9 to 5. It can be 11 o'clock at night, midnight. You're still thinking about what needs to be done tomorrow, what needs to be done next month, what needs to be done next year. What chances can you take? How's the bank balance? Have they paid that invoice? You never switch off when you're self-employed, when you run a business, especially if you have staff. And I've had staff in the past because you've got their lives. And that's where I developed my personal sense of responsibility, but it was always internal, my personal responsibility. It was never, what can I do for anybody else?
Yeah, I hear you. What you said about traveling there is such an important point. It's something I'm very blessed to have lived in multiple countries and also beyond that traveled to, I think, about 35 different countries now. And even with a concept such as poverty is it's a very relative concept. So if you're talking about poverty in the UK versus poverty on a global level, it may as well be two different words. Right. Yeah. We're talking totally different living standards and access to certain things, etc. So, of course, I understand in any country, in any city, in any place, you're going to have a top 1% or 10% and a bottom 1% or 10% in terms of income, wealth, etc. And that looks really, really different in different countries. So someone who's in, say, the bottom 10% in the UK, like you said, on a global level, they're still likely in the top 10% globally. They're not going to be, you know, risking dying of starvation or malnutrition or, you know, dying of certain diseases or just not having access to even, you know, basic things like plumbing, right? Having a toilet and running water, et cetera, electricity, things that we in the UK, you don't even think about, right? Someone could be in so-called poverty in the UK. They still have a 50-inch television. You know, a car sometimes, in some cases, even two cars. Yeah. But you know, people are still considered poor there. But when you see other parts of the world, if you go to parts of Asia, Africa, South America, especially, et cetera, then you see, you get that perspective, and that perspective gives you the gratitude, I think, to understand, okay, maybe stuff isn't wherever you're from. Maybe stuff isn't perfect, but you're still very lucky, very fortunate, very blessed. And you, even if you don't have those things now, you've got the opportunity to rise up, right? You could come from a council estate, I don't know, single mother, single father, whatever the situation is in the UK, USA, countries like this, but there's upward mobility. So you can at least, it's not saying it's going to be easy for everybody, but you can see a pathway. Whereas again, in some places, unless you emigrate or something, the ceiling is very, very low.
No, absolutely. And I do understand when people get a bit angry in, you know, Western world, when they see somebody else with a lot more than they have, even though what they have is a lot more than the rest of the world. Yeah. I understand that comparison. And to a certain extent, that's fine because you can work towards that. What it taught me was not to be envious of what other people have, because I know I have enough. I mean, I want more. Of course, I'm human. We always want more. But it made me realize and made me start appreciating what I had that wasn't materialistic. Mm. It was family. It was friends. It was my health. It was little things like, even when I was unemployed decades ago, I had something called the public library. And I was always taking books out and reading. Most countries in the world don't have libraries. And it's all these little things we take for granted in the UK that in the rest of the world don't exist, or they wish they had. Mm-hmm. And we need to acknowledge that and say thank you to the people who went before, who made this country and made our lives better today by the sacrifices and the fights they had generations ago. And we just need to look back sometimes and go, thank you for that. Mm.
Why do you think that's so rare? Why do you think people don't do that more often?
Take me as an example, selfish. Mm. Through my teens and 20s, pure, simple, selfish, looking out for myself. And it's a human trait.
It's weird. I feel like we live in a time where it's almost trendy to be negative and to take the worst view and interpretation of everything. It's almost like there have been so many wins. I mean, if you look over the past 100 years, or the past century, the amount of progress in a country like the on every front, that is something that should be acknowledged and celebrated, as far as I'm concerned. It doesn't mean that, you know, it's very, very, we were just talking about before we jumped on this call, it's extremely important to be aware of history, and to know of bad things that have happened and atrocities and things that, but with that, it's also being aware of the progress that has been made. And it seems like it's really, really trendy to criticize everything and want to tear down and dismantle and deconstruct everything and, you know, erase everything, cancel everybody, even if they're already dead, etc., and not think, okay, hang on, what led to the prosperity we have now? And what are some of the good things? What are the positives that we can take away from these people in the past? But it seems like that's not a very popular view these days.
No, and it's because we keep comparing today with utopia. Instead, we should be comparing today with yesterday or a decade ago or 50 years ago, because we've come such a long way. My uncles, so the brothers of my dead father, have told me many stories about when I was a baby in his arms, and he was an Irish immigrant, came over here with nothing, with a shovel and a pickaxe to build the roads. And he couldn't get accommodation because he was Irish.
Yeah.
And he'd be turned away. He used to have to send my mum, who was English, with me on their own to get the accommodation. Then he would turn up once they got the keys and paid the deposit, because once they heard his accent, in most places, it wasn't welcome.
Yeah.
And we look at that to compare to now.
Yeah.
And we look at the, I read a book a couple of months ago. You may have already read it. George Orwell Wrote to Wigan Pier.
I haven't actually read that one. I've read 1984 and Animal Farm, but I haven't read that one.
Read that. It's about poverty in the north of England. And it's poverty. And all I kept thinking when I was reading this book was, this would have been my life if I was born in the 1930s. This would have been me.
Yep.
I don't think I'm strong enough to have done that work, because we're a weaker breed now than we were, you know, 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Now, that was hard, back-breaking work surrounded by poverty and malnutrition.
I haven't read the book, but is that the one where he talks about people having to, like, crawl in these tunnels
in the miners?
I've read an excerpt from it, because I know a little bit about it, but I don't think I've read the whole book.
It's well worth reading. And what I like about it is, at some point he says, I'm paraphrasing now, this isn't word for word what he says, but he says something along the lines of, the English like the idea of socialism, they just can't stand socialists. And I read that and went, that is so apt. That's just like today. We all want a fairer society, but we can't stand the idiots, the woke idiots who are banging on about how unfair life is in their mansions, on their iPhones, driving BMWs.
It's really interesting, that story you said actually about your dad with the accommodation, because in fact, the same thing happened to my father when he came to the UK. And he's a medical doctor, and he had the same thing. I do need to get my dad on this podcast, because he has infinite stories. But it's interesting you said that your dad faced that as an Irish immigrant, because, again, with some of these issues, because, again, we live in this time where everything is racialized, right? Everything is just, you know, race, white. It's people literally talk like it's black and white. And so people, again, they forget to acknowledge that these type of discrimination and prejudice and, you know, xenophobia, racism, whatever it is, it can run in different ways, right? So now people would never even... I don't know, like, Irish have kind of just been brought into the, I guess, terminology of what people now would call white. But it's like, okay, that wasn't always the case. And even if you go to a black majority country where you have different ethnic groups and tribes, et cetera, there's still discrimination and biases and things like that. And again, I think when people have this very sort of limited Western worldview, they just see it as, it's just black and white, it's just skin color. And it's like, no, it's tribalism. Which can be based on skin color, but it can also be based on all these other things. And it seems like it's just something about human nature, and just foolishness and stupidity, really, more than it is something that's just about, okay, it's just the skin color and that's it.
It is, it's tribalism, and it's also genetic. We're programmed to promote our own tribe, because our genes are shared within that tribe, and it's about promoting and pushing our genes forward into history. So it is a human trait. That doesn't mean we can't overcome it, because we've made great advances and we are overcoming it, and most people have fully overcome it. So it, even though it's a human trait, it's not set in stone.
No.
And we see it all over. We see it in football matches. That's tribalism when you have, you know, football hooliganism. You look at Northern Ireland. There's no genetic differences between people in Northern Ireland. And they spent decades killing each other. I have family there. My stepdad is from there. I've had holidays in Northern Ireland in different parts. I understand that issue there. And it all comes down to tribalism, us and them. And I'm on the side of us.
Yeah. And it's extra interesting in Northern Ireland because, again, you're talking about, you know, if you're talking about the violence between Protestants and Catholics, there are still all Christians. Not only are you all Irish, you're actually the same. You're just different denominations of the same religion. And then even if you look at things like Islamic terrorism, you know, who are the majority of victims? It's other Muslims. It's other followers of Islam. It's just different denominations. I mean, it's a bizarre thing, man. Human beings are, I always say human beings are both the best and the worst thing in the world. There's so much love and generosity and kindness and meaning and family and all these wonderful things. But then it's also just like, gosh, what is wrong with people? You look at history, even you look at the now and you're just like, why do people do some of these things? But I'm really curious to learn more about about this charity work that you've done. So you actually founded a charity, is that correct?
Yes, so a decade ago.
Okay, and what was that about? Tell us about it.
So I took redundancy from the council and I used that money in my savings and I ploughed it into a charity. And what I wanted to do was hire youth workers to work on the streets in the evenings, at weekends, in the parks, outside shops, on the street corners, and go to where the young people are and build up relationships and offer them advice and guidance. So rather than waiting for young people to either make a mistake and then get in the system to get help and support, or to walk into a youth club and ask for help and support, which they won't do, why don't we take services out to young people? Why aren't we customer focused? You know, why do we expect young people just to accept what we're willing to give them? No, let's go to them and let's give them a quality service. So we go to the areas that are having problems with, you know, youth crime, antisocial behaviour. We go to the spots where either young people are involved in negative behaviour or they may be maybe involved in risky behaviour. And we build up a relationship. It may take months to build up a relationship sometimes, but we build up a relationship and then we can have frank conversations and we talk about things like employment. We can get them jobs if they're over 16. If they're in relationships, we talk about what a positive relationship looks like, what safe sex looks like and why you need to practice safe sex. We can do training on a phallic symbol about how to put condoms on because you need to know for when you need to use one.
Yeah.
We have conversations around drugs and alcohol. We break down some of the myths and then we give them the right information. And you know, it's not as simple as saying, don't do drugs. We all know don't do drugs, but I'm going to do them anyway. But if you're going to do it anyway, that'll show you how to be as safe as you possibly can. And then if you come across like girls drinking in the park, you know, it's like, we know you're going to carry on drinking, but we say to them, you all need to stay together. She's drunk now. You're all responsible for her because she's drunk. Do not leave her on her own. Gotcha. And it's about that advice and guidance. And we just try to do what we can to give these young people some positive options.
Awesome. And how long were you working at that charity for? You said you started it, you say over a decade ago?
It's been 10 years. 10 years, 10 years. This year. So okay.
So you had an incident last year where to use the modern day parlance, you got canceled, essentially.
Yep.
You came under a lot of criticism and scrutiny. What happened?
So it was summer last year. George Floyd had died. We had some protests in the UK for Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. And I had not really heard of that organization before. I think the first time I'd have heard of it was seeing you on Twitter.
Okay.
So I blame you. I blame you for everything, Zubi. I blame
you. Fair enough. I'll take it. Scapegoat.
I Googled Black Lives Matter to find out what they were. I just thought it was an anti-racist organization.
Yeah.
So I Googled it, read their website, read their aims, their objectives, and thought to myself, this has got nothing to do with being anti-racist. This is a Marxist organization. In fact, it's a postmodern Marxist organization. They've swapped the working class for racism. That's what they've done. And they want to dismantle the nuclear family. They want to overthrow capitalism. They want to defund the police. And I'm reading this going, this is crazy. Does anybody know any of this? So I spoke to my family and friends and they just said, oh no, it's an anti-racist organization because of the death of that poor black man in America with a police officer. And I said, no, it's not. So I decided to write a blog, and I wrote several blogs before. So I wrote a 700-word blog explaining what I'd found out, and then ending with, and if we really want to improve the lives of Black people in the UK, this is what I would suggest. So I talked about knife crime, genital mutilation, and I ended it with, and why don't we build some houses? Because not only what, because where are all these people going to live? And building houses will improve everyone's life, everyone's children's lives. So I published that on LinkedIn, and it got some comments, and it was all fine. And then someone cut and pasted the link onto Twitter, and Twitter's mental, and Twitter did what it always does. So there was a big outcry on Twitter. I got called a racist and a Nazi. Oh, wow. I had one woman email, sorry, she messaged me on Twitter saying, I take on board all your charity work you've done, but you're still a Nazi. I just think you're a compassionate Nazi.
Wow.
And that was the best insult I ever had, a compassionate Nazi.
Wow. Okay, and then what?
So then someone set up a petition to have me fired. That got 450 signatures. The board of my charity, who I appointed, panicked.
Did you say 450?
450 signatures.
That's not even a lot, but yeah, carry on.
That's nothing. But at the time, it felt like the world.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm a bit flippant about the incident now, but believe me, at the time, the pressure, the stress, my board panicked. They didn't believe any of it, but they wanted all this to go away. So they sacked me over email.
Wow.
And then I decided, no, I'm not having this. So I mounted a fight back. I then went to the press, got quite a lot of press, actually, especially with the Mail on Sunday. Mm-hmm. The Free Speech Union came to my rescue as well. We got a Slitters on board. The online mob all disappeared. Once I got national press, every single one of them disappeared. Not one more person ever criticized me again on social media. That's shut them all up. Yeah, they were just bullies.
Yeah.
Once they realized my gang was now bigger than their gang, they just all walked away and went, do you know what? I'm scared now to have this fight. There'll be someone weak around the corner. Let's go pick on them. That's exactly what they did.
Yep.
And then we looked at the board of my charity, and I threatened them with legal action for breach of contract, and they resigned within 18 hours. So they were cowards as well. 18 hours. That's how much they stuck up for the charity. It took them 18 hours.
Wow, that's quite an experience. I mean, what was it like when you were going through it? I mean, like you said, you can talk about it, you know, flippantly now, but it must have been intense. It must have been a lot.
Oh, horrendous, horrendous. Yeah. And at this time, I just had the birth of my first grandchild.
Okay.
And that was really upsetting that I wasn't there for my grandchild. I was stressed. You know, we're bonding now, but it really damaged my relationship with my newborn grandchild. That was the biggest downside to what happened. The pressure, the stress, the amount of people who would phone me or email me to say, Nick, this is appalling. I agree with you. Everything you said's fine, but I can't say any of it online or publicly because I'm worried about my job. And it was like, fair enough. You've got a mortgage and a family. I don't want you to die on your sword for me.
Yeah.
It was a learning curve, and it's changed my life. It's made me reevaluate what I'm doing and where I'm going, and I have made quite a lot of changes because of it all.
Gotcha. Where was most of the criticism coming from?
Twitter.
Okay. I mean, in sort of, was this mainly UK-based people? Did it hit the sort of US crowd on Twitter?
No.
Just UK. Okay.
It was mainly UK, and a lot of it was focused around Greater Manchester. Okay, because I've actually got a list of all the 450 people who signed the petition. Because after I was fired, the person who set the petition up sent the list of names that printed that out off change.org and sent it to the board to say, you made the right decision, and this is a list of the names. So when I came back into post, it was in my email box.
Oh, wow.
I looked through it, and some of the names upset me. It was like there was one person who I spent hours with helping, trying to get them a job. I then offered them a place on my board several years ago because I needed more experience.
Okay.
So he was on my board of my charity. There was another couple of people who were the adult children of a member of staff of mine. And what was upsetting there was, I found the list 8 months after I came back.
Okay.
But when I came back, because of the damage to the charity, I had to make some members of staff redundant. Mm-hmm. And their mum was made redundant. So her children wanting me fired.
I see.
Led to their mum being made redundant because of the damage to the charity where she worked, which is quite ironic.
Yeah, it is. I mean, what were the charges being levied at you? The usual stuff, I guess, just racist, or
not so much that, because some people said that.
Okay.
But I think the biggest accusation was writing while white.
Oh.
Because as a white man, I'm not allowed to write about black issues. And that was the main accusation. Who am I to comment on this issue about black people? Who am I to put forward what we should be working on to improve the lives of black people? Who am I as a white man to have any say on this matter? That was the main accusation.
Interesting. As if as if no white person has ever done that one before.
Yeah, and I don't forget, and I just spent 2 decades
of course, I'm aware.
Working in Greater Manchester with young people.
Yeah.
And, you know, probably 30, 40, 50% of those people, I would class as Asian, black, mixed race. So it's just
crazy, though, because to these kind of mobs, like, that stuff doesn't even matter, you know, because it's all performative. It's performative and it's bullying. It's not about what is making a tangible difference. It's just virtue signaling and it's performance. It's, you know, hey, look, I put BLM in my bio. Hey, look, I posted a black square on Instagram. Hey, look, I held up this sign or whatever. It's performative. It's not, okay, what are real world tangible things that are going to make this difference, right? The statement, you know, I mean, Black Lives Matter has to be the most intelligently and sneakily brilliantly named organization ever conceived, because they nailed it with that one, because any criticism of their organization is met with, oh, so you disagree with the statement, right?
And, yes.
You know, that's obviously was done intentionally. I've been talking about this since 2016, right? Privately, you know, because the organization has been around for a while. I don't know why last year with the George Floyd thing, that one particularly went very international.
Lockdown.
Maybe, I was going to say, actually, probably because people just wanted to get out of the house for something. But, you know, they've been playing this game for a long time. I myself have taken a lot of heat, a lot of flack. Yeah. I won't even get into it all for criticizing Black Lives Matter too early, right? Because in the summer, everyone was all hyped up and was jumping on the bandwagon. But I've noticed that now it's okay to criticize BLM now, right? Like enough people have taken the initial bullets for other people to be more bold and to come out there and, you know, and then there's been this bombshell that dropped just a couple days ago about the founder buying, spending millions of dollars buying all these homes and so on.
Black mansions matter.
it just blows my mind. But the crazy thing with this is, I mean, maybe you've had this, but the people who make these criticisms, it's very rare for them to, even if they're proven wrong and you're vindicated, it's very rare for them to come back and say, you know what? Actually, you were right. Like I've looked into this thing properly and okay, you had some good points to make. It's like, you know, they kind of sneak off and disappear. And that's the thing I kind of find extra annoying, because it's like, oh, come on. Like at least, you know, if you've done that to someone or you just were that wrong, it's like at least say, okay, I was wrong on this one.
It's taken on a form of orthodoxy, ideology, and it's very similar to a religion now. So if your religion commits atrocities or believes in crazy stuff, you still go along with it because it's your religion. And that's what this anti-racist woke agenda is. So even when we can prove them wrong, they still won't believe it, because then the words you're using, they will change. So this isn't racist, because we've redefined the word racist now.
Change the word, yeah.
Yeah, and they'll come up with a new phrase. And when you were talking before about it being performative, I look at it more like a game. So you say this, so I've got a card for that. It's called institutional racism. There we go. Mm-hmm. You're going to say that. I'm going to pull a card out called oppressed minority. Bang, there you go. Yeah. And it's like playing top trumps. They're pulling out cards with their best phrase on it, and they're putting that on the table.
Yeah, yeah. And it's all the same. There are certain just phrases and words and buzzwords. It's like if you remove these 15 terms, then they can't even speak anymore because like they, and they can't even define them. So if you ask people, in most cases, if you ask people, okay, what do you mean by that? You know, they just respond by being indignant or telling you to educate yourself or read a book or be better rather than, you know.
And what do you mean by that? I don't know what you mean by that, because that sounds like whiteness. You're asking people to explain words. That's whiteness.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just being on time and whiteness. And being punctual, whiteness.
Yeah. Sounds like white supremacy to me. Yes. And then there's now they're talking about multiracial whiteness, aren't they? And multiracial white supremacy, as if like, you know, it blows my mind. I think I don't know. I think in the West, I think maybe this is one of the downsides of I'm a free speech absolutist, but I think one of the downsides of free speech is people perhaps think that everyone's speech or everyone's ideas need to be sort of taken equally seriously. Because we're just running with a lot of really stupid, really bad ideas, which in the past, I think people would have just been like, what are you talking about? Like, you go in the loony bin. Whereas now it's like, okay, wait, like, let's consider that one, you know? Oh, maybe men should compete against women in pro sports. Like, maybe, yeah, actually, and it's just bizarre to me. I'm like, you can clearly see anyone sane knows that certain ideas are just terrible, terrible ideas that are going to harm society. But we've somehow reached this strange place where so many people are cowed and afraid that they won't speak up on some of these things, even though they themselves know, okay, this is bonkers. This does not make sense. You're saying that the sky is yellow when I can clearly see that it's blue, but I don't want to be the first person to say that the sky is actually blue, because then I'll get the mob on me. Mm-hmm. And as you've alluded to, and as I try to tell people, the mobs are not that scary. These online mobs are cowards. It's even why they attack. It's why they attack in packs. And if you stand your ground, they will disappear very, very quickly. They'll go away. You know, they'll hunt for 48 hours, and then if you don't give in and you don't do the weird fake apology or whatever, they'll go away and they'll find someone else to bother. Because as you said, it's a game. It's like head hunting, right? They just want to get you. Hey, we got this one. Another one. Another scalp. And that's what it is.
How do you take anyone seriously online who doesn't give you their real name and calls themselves Patman82? How can you be a sensible person and take that person's views sensibly when they're called Patman82? Mm. I always have my full name and who I am on my bio for several reasons. But one of the main benefits of that is it makes me sane, as in it makes what I put, I think about what I type.
Yes.
Because this is going to represent me now.
Yes.
And just like you, you'll get a message off somebody who just wants to go, but I have to go, no, I need to be professional. So I'm not going to answer that person. But when you're Patman82, you can say whatever the hell you want to say, and it makes you brave behind that keyboard. So I advise everybody, don't be a coward. Put your full name on your bio and stand by the words you say, and that will make you a real person.
I'm with you on that, man, 100%. So I want to talk about you running for – you're currently running for mayor. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so the election's the 6th of May. And in Greater Manchester, which is, for your viewers, it's a large region in the north of England. And we have a mayor who looks after that region. There's quite a lot of powers. Looks after many things, transport, the police, lots of other things there. Mm-hmm. And his term is up, and there's about 9 people standing. And I decided to put myself forward for 2 main reasons, really. The first reason is, in Manchester, we've got a serious problem with rough sleeping, people sleeping on the streets and dying on the streets. Mm. And this problem only started 10 years ago. Up to that point, we really didn't have a problem in the UK. You know, we're quite lucky. We've got a social benefit system here. But we've now got people living, you know, hundreds living in Manchester on the streets. And I've had enough. I've had enough of walking past these people. And I've run homeless projects. I've worked on the streets with these people, getting them into accommodation, getting them into employment. It can be done. Mm-hmm. It takes political will and determination. It's not even an issue of money. We're spending hundreds of millions on this and achieving nothing. So I want to end that. And because every politician says this and promises to end it and never seems to, I put my neck on the chopping block. I'll end this within a year or I'll resign. Because it's about time we had some politicians who put some meat on the bones and says, this is a promise and this is what will happen. And if I don't resign at the end of the year, I want people to play all these clips back to me and say to me, you're being corrupted, Nick. Doing what you said you're going to fight against. You need to resign. And hopefully I will resign, but I think I'll fix it.
Okay.
And the second point I wanted to stand on was Greater Manchester Police. So we've got a dedicated police force for this area. And it's been judged by the government for the last 4 years as failing. And then in December just gone, it was put into special measures, which means it's failing that badly, the government of having to step in now to help run it. And it's, what have we done here? How have we run our police force into the ground over 4 years when we've had a mayor overseeing it all? So the chief constable, who's the top police officer in the force, walked away and retired.
Okay.
So we allowed him to retire. If you worked anywhere else in the world and you ran your organisation into the ground, you'd be sacked. You let him resign on full benefits and just walk away. And then the mayor, who's ultimately responsible, has washed his hands of the whole thing and went, not my fault. Even though I'm in charge, not my fault. So I want to save Greater Manchester Police. It's becoming too woke.
Okay.
We're looking at too much. You know, we're policing the internet too much instead of the streets. I want to get back to basics. I want to increase public confidence in the police. And I want the police to catch criminals. We've got knife crime. We've got people dying on the streets in Greater Manchester. Let's tackle that instead of tackling some of the other issues.
I like that. I think that's very realistic and pragmatic. And I like that it's two main points, because when politicians of any stripe promise everything, promise the world, then I become more skeptical, right? Because it's like, well, you're not going to be able to do all of that. So why not take two or three and really work on it? With the homelessness issue, that's something that really intrigues me. Number one, what do you think it was that caused, you said it in the past 10 years, it became a much bigger issue. What was it that happened 10 years ago that led to that?
So 10 years ago, we entered a period of austerity where the government cut all the budgets, hence why I was made redundant.
Gotcha.
So we came out of the 2008 crash and cuts started coming, and governments and councils, not the council's fault because they get their money from central government. And Manchester Council has had 55% of its budget cut over the last 10 years. So these are huge cuts. So they had to make some real difficult choices. So a lot of the funding to the small charities who'd be working with vulnerable people all got cut. Okay. Some of the services from drug addiction, mental health got cut. Some of the homeless services got cut. And people went bang, 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 bang. And some people found themselves on the streets.
Gotcha.
And then at the same time, we then had cuts to the police. So people who would be begging all day in Manchester City Centre, we then allowed them to beg all day to buy drugs, which then compounded their mental health issues, which made them then stay on the streets even longer. And it was like a perfect storm. And that's how 10 years ago we developed this huge problem in Greater Manchester.
Interesting. Interesting. I used to go to Manchester quite a lot to sell my CDs in the city center there. So I'm very, very familiar with Manchester city center. I mean, homelessness is it's such a tricky one, because it's something that's universal and has, as far as I know, has always existed to, you know, at least to some extent. In some places it's awful. I don't know if you've ever been to like Los Angeles or San Francisco or ridiculous there. Like it's not,
I've
like
seen,
anything.
Yeah. Okay. I've not been there recently. I mean, I've seen some of the Western countries. Like, I was shocked when I saw it in Canada, and I was shocked when I saw it in Australia. Living on the streets.
Yeah.
I sort of was half expecting it the times I've been to America.
I'll tell you, LA and San Francisco are something else. They're something else. I've been to every city in the UK, and there is nothing in the UK that even, I mean, just LA, they have 60,000 homeless. 60,000. And it's not just that they're homeless, it's the levels of drug addiction and the obvious mental health problems. And, you know, I'd never seen people just smoking crack on the street and shooting heroin on the street until I went to California in 2019.
Well, come to Manchester, you'll find
that
now.
Really, really.
Open drug injection, open drug dealing. We've got the homeless people fighting among themselves and stabbing each other. Yeah. We've got homeless people with squeezy bottles of bleach.
Yikes.
Because it's a defensive weapon that if you come near me, I'm going to squeeze this bleach in your face.
Yikes.
So the violence inside this group is horrendous, and we need to save them from themselves as well.
I get you. Okay. And how are you going to do that? What policies do you have in place to make a real and genuine change there?
So the first thing I'll do is we need to crack down on begging, because begging funds the drug addiction. Mm-hmm. And it's a drug addiction that keeps people on the streets and forces them to turn away support, because all they can think about is, I have three more hours now to beg for more money for more drugs, because I need more drugs in 3 hours. Mm-hmm. So I don't want any help and support. I'm concentrating on begging for money for drugs. So we need to crack down on the begging trade. People then will obviously take less drugs, and they'll be in a better position then to be spoken to and hopefully offered help and support. At the moment, we have a one-size-fits-all. So when we're working with rough sleepers on the streets, the councils, other services will say, this is what we can do for you. Do you want it? Mm-hmm. And the answer is usually, no, I don't want that. Mm-hmm. So why do we keep offering the same services? What's wrong with these services that people would rather live on the streets and slowly die than take the help and support on offer? And the answer is no customer service, no customer choice. We want to do things to these individuals. I'm going to do this for you. I'm going to do this to you. Mm-hmm. Well, we should be sat down going, here's your choices. Here's your choices. This hostel, that hostel, you don't want a hostel yet. That's fine. But let's get that leg looked at so you don't have to amputate it. Let's look at getting you some drug support. If you want to stay on the streets for a bit longer, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But let's start this journey doing something. Give you some choices. When you get people, vulnerable people, broken people, they've given up making choices in life, and that's part of their problem. Mm. And what we need to do with broken people is to give them choices. Sometimes as simple as, do you want a tea or a coffee? It's your drink. You need to decide. Mm. And the more they make, and it sounds a bit silly, but the more they make some of these choices, the more they realize, I'm a person. Mm. I'm human. And the choices I make affect my life. Mm. So therefore, maybe I should make some better choices and think ahead. And this is a slow process. And then some of the hostels we can get people into, some you'd never want to sleep in yourself because, you know, they're dangerous. You're going to get robbed if, you know, the violent, strong people dominate. We need to split people up. We need to say to people, you've not got a drug issue, so we're going to move you straight into hostel B because that's for people with low need. That's for people we can move on really quickly. You need to go to hostel A, because it's a lot smaller. There's only 4 beds there. We've got a drugs worker there all the time. And this isn't rocket science. The people who are running the services at the moment in Greater Manchester, the people who have been running them for decades. So they haven't solved it, but we keep asking the same people to keep solving the same problem by doing the same things. Mm. And that's madness. They keep getting the same results.
Do you think that's perhaps because there's a perverse incentive there, perhaps not to solve the problem? I think that can often be an issue with... public services or certain jobs, right? Where actually if you solve the problem, then you're out of work. There's like a weird, a weird incentive there. It's a bit like a personal trainer who doesn't really want their client to lose weight or learn how to do those exercises properly, because then they could be out of a job.
Yeah, a bit like a race hustler. It doesn't want to admit that.
I was actually going to use that example, but I was like, you know what? Let me use one that's a little less a little less on the nose.
I agree. And the charity sector needs looking at. So, and rough sleeping in Greater Manchester is a multi-million pound business. So some people have got a vested interest. I've not got to a stage yet where I would say they're not trying to solve the problem. I've never met anybody yet like that. So I don't want to go that far down that road, but it is an industry. But again, with charities, what I would like to see with charities, but this would have to be a national thing in the UK, is we have charities. You set a charity up and you state what your aims are, and then you're held accountable to your aims. That my charity will work with young people to help them make positive choices. A charity should also state when they've achieved their goal, and then they should close down. So what we have with charities is mission creep. So do you know what? Child poverty isn't child poverty anymore in the UK. So what we'll do is we'll change the definition of what child poverty is so we can keep going. And now we're going to look at this. And we just keep pushing and pushing because we're a multi-million pound organization.
Yeah.
I've got a golden plated pension and I don't want to close this charity down. So let's just keep saying we've got issues. Charities need to stay when they've achieved their goal and they need to close down and then start a new charity up with a new goal. And that's what we need to do.
That's a fantastic point. I've never actually, that's not something I've ever considered before, but that's a brilliant point because yeah, there's so much scope creep in these things. And as we know with any organization, whether it's a company or let alone a government or an NGO, whatever, they always tend towards growth, right? Just growing and growing and entering this and entering that. And after a while, I'm like, wait, what is your purpose? Like, what are you doing? It's a bit like when I'm seeing these, it's a whole other issue, but with some of the police when they're starting to, you know, like, why are police like putting rainbow flags and transgender flags on their cars and going to like, I'm like, you're the police. Like, are the stabbings down to zero? No, then stop. Absolutely. Right.
Yeah,
you know, absolutely. You're there policing tweets and harassing people for Facebook posts or for no, I'm like, wait, hang on. Are the murders, rapes, assaults, robberies, are these things down to zero? If they are, then cool. We don't need police anymore. I'll support. I'm with you. Defund the police. But if not, but if not, then please stop with this nonsense and get back out there and solve the problems that actually need to be solved. Like all this virtue signaling and nonsense. It's like nobody wants this. Nobody asked for this. Nobody wanted it. Just stop. You know,
it goes beyond that, especially for the UK police and Greater Manchester Police. For me, it's what's the word I'm looking for? It's a lack of professionalism.
Mm.
So we'll have police officers dressed up as rainbows for the Pride Parade. Now, police officers should be at the Pride Parade to maintain law and order.
To police.
They should be there. Yeah. They shouldn't be there to take part of the parade and be entertainment because that's not what we're paying for. And it's crazy. The amount of police officers I see who don't even shave. And it's like, you're a public servant. I expect you to shave. Tattoos halfway up the neck and the face. And you're a police officer. It's like, no, we need to professionalize the service. And my biggest pet hate is police officers who call members of the public love and mate. It's like, excuse me, he's sir and she's madam. No matter what your engagement is, I don't want you to be their friends. I want you to offer professional service because if you don't, they then presume this is personal, that your interaction is personal. Mm-hmm. And if they have a bad experience, it's because it was personal. Yeah. It should be, I don't care who you are. I don't care what you believe. All I'm going to do is enforce the law.
Yeah,
that's my job. And then you see police officers on these TV programs, the fly on the wall documentaries where they're arresting somebody and they're rolling around in the mud, putting handcuffs on somebody. And they're shouting, stop struggling, you muppet. It's like, you don't have to abuse. I know you're fighting with the person and you should be fighting with them and you should be putting, I agree with all that.
Yeah.
But even at that point, you should be shouting, stop struggling, sir, because you're a public servant.
Yeah.
And we've got away from all this. The police need professionalizing now in our country. Mm. And if I become mayor, they won't.
I hear that. I mean, some of the police in the USA are I mean, they're effing and they're just swearing at people and cause I'm just like, dude, you know, I'm gonna effing shoot you. I'm like this isn't just unprofessional, this is like some militarization of, you know, I guess everything has its pros and cons, but yeah, you see some videos. Yeah, I mean, I've seen bad videos from the UK, but certainly
again, you've said the crucial word, video.
Yeah,
everybody has a video phone.
Mm-hmm.
What you may have got away with 10, 20 years ago, it's over. Yeah. Everyone's got a video phone. So I like the public recording the police. The police should never be scared of the public recording them because you shouldn't be doing anything wrong.
That's true.
And have you noticed since we've got video phones, there's no more UFO sightings?
I also noticed last year that I think the Pentagon pretty much like borderline admitted that they have like evidence, they have genuine evidence of UFOs, but there was so much other stuff going on and everyone was so obsessed with Trump and the virus and whatever, that they sort of glossed over that. And I was like, wait, hang on, like, aliens, like, can we talk about the aliens? But yeah, people's attention is a funny thing. So what is, I was going to say, what is next for you, but I already know you're running for mayor. You've got a book. Is your book is coming out, or it's out already? Tell us about your book.
I'm in the process of looking for a publisher. So if you're a publisher out there, please get in contact. We're approaching publishers at the moment, but we've not got a deal yet.
Okay.
It's called Lessons in Courage, A Journey into Personal Responsibility. Mm. So it starts off about me and my life, about how I've got to where I am, what happened to me in the summer, and how I fought back, and how I had the courage and the skills to fight back. And I can relate all of that back to past experiences. So growing up as a child in school and stuttering, you know, all the way through school, I stuttered when I tried to talk out loud in class. So you can imagine the stick I got. And that toughened me up.
Yeah.
You know, living on that tough council estate toughened me up. So I talk about that. And then I also talk about how we all need to be more courageous, because at the moment, all we're doing in society is being cowards. We're allowing things that we know are wrong to happen because we're too scared to speak out. And where this is going to take us could be somewhere really, really dark if people don't start standing up and saying, the king is in the all together, instead of just nodding and agreeing. And that's what we need to do, because the vast majority of people know right from wrong, and they know what silly is, and they know what sensible is. And we know these things. Mm-hmm. People just need to stand up and go, this is what I believe.
I love that. Nick Buckley, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been really good to talk to you. Where can people find and follow you on social media?
I'm on virtually all the social media sites at Nick Buckley MBE, all one word. And I've got a Patreon account where I write articles, videos, that, again, Nick Buckley MBE.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Nick. Great to talk to you.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the gram, stunt you're destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam, put some respect on my name. Sick like Cobain, click and I bang, y'all gon' remember the name. Y'all gon' remember the name.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.